was maybe before.
Yeah, BC.
So BC, and now actually is AC. We're very glad to have her here. She's in New Zealand, and she's especially conducting this seminar series on career karma, which is all about understanding what our propensity is, what our nature is, and understanding how we can apply that best, engage that best. And so today is the fourth seminar in the fourth presentation of the whole series. And today she's going to do an overview, so where she's also going to recap some points from the previous presentation and also present some admiring new points. So please, let's welcome her with a big round of applause.
To turn off maybe some of the like the lights here between the projector and the screen without turning off the other ones, or are they all just one bank?
They can all be turned on.
Oh, there we go. That's nice. Okay, thank you. Okay, so it's January 6th, 2023 here in Auckland. And can you over there see the screen, Will?
Yeah, 2024.
I'm sorry. At the risk of becoming emotional, which I probably will. So one of our old members of our Auckland community and a very dear friend of mine, Pranapa, who just passed in this world today after a long cancer battle, and I'd like to dedicate this to him. So on January 5th, 2024, right? 26th. Okay. Let me just settle for it. It's been a little hard. I got to see him in India when I was just there a few weeks ago. He was the one who brought me first to New Zealand. He was the one who invited me here and facilitated me writing children's curriculum here. I had met him before that, and I had headed up a curriculum committee for like 6 months in America that he had worked on. And just, he ran the school here in Auckland for how many years did he run the school?
9 or 10 years,
yeah. And just, one of the kindest, most caring people that I've ever met. Yeah? Anything, Krishna, you'd like to say about Prana?
He's my best friend.
Yeah, he's one of my best friends, too. All right, now hopefully I can remember what date it is. So I'm going to see if I can get it right now. It's January 6th, 2024. So anyway, I'm dedicating this to him. A lot of what I've done in education is really due to his kindness and his support. It's a hard world, you know. And people that you love and that you care for aren't always with you, and sometimes they leave a lot younger than you think they should. All right. So, we are going to look at 9 timeless principles to identify and live your ideal career. Because Krishna consciousness is not just about transcendence. It's not just about becoming free from the material world and attaining a higher state of consciousness. It's also about how to have an ideal life while we're in this world. How to make this whole world such that everything we do is part of our spiritual experience. So tonight I'm going to be looking at that in terms of career and how a society works together economically and socially. Tomorrow at Nivarshana, I'm going to look at that with our other book, our Krishna Meditations book, in terms of how the light of the sun and our breath and our feeling of aliveness and the birds and the trees and the clouds all connect us with the divine. So here we're going to learn how to identify our nature and use it in Krishna's service. And if you're interested in more information, you can sign up on our mailing list. We are in the process of making a full online course. So we've already recorded the videos, and we decided on the platform, and we're just working on the auxiliary materials. I'm hoping sometime this year will be available. We're also working on an audiobook version of the book. And so if you want just notices of when that's out, you can sign up on the list. I know you will not immediately get an email confirmation. We're really simple. It's just my co-author, Dr. Ruchira Datta, and myself. So, but we will get your name, and we won't spam your inbox or anything. We'll just simply let you know when those things are ready. I'd like you to imagine that your daily life has gradually come to include all the practices and activities that you've always dreamed of, that you love the work you're doing, what you're producing, and how you're making a meaningful contribution, that your work is bringing you the kinds of prosperity that truly enrich you and that you joyfully share with others. Now imagine the whole world was like that. So we're going to look at four main categories, identifying our ideal career field and prosperity type, and that's mostly what we talked about in the previous classes. So we are going to talk about that again tonight, not as in-depth, but since many of you weren't there, we are going to talk about it enough to get at least a basic understanding, and I've summarized some of that here. Then also beyond that, because a lot of people are just interested in that, you know, what's my nature, how can I match my nature to career? But that's not enough for us to be really satisfied in our work. We need to go beyond that to learn the secrets of making our work deeply meaningful, and that's not enough. We want to go beyond that to progress to dharmic mastery. And then we're also briefly going to look at what would a whole social and economic system be for peace and prosperity. Now, this was a phrase that my spiritual teacher, my spiritual master, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, used almost 200 times, wanting a society of peace and prosperity. So we're going to look at 9 principles of career dharma. I wonder if you could read these with me. Connecting our nature with our livelihood, advancing through life while nourishing our nature, extending our prosperity to others, ethical and meaningful work of value, delight in cherishing our prosperity and field of work, having celebrations of the sacred in our life and work, above the shades of ego, maintaining societal balance, cooperation between the fields, and competition within the fields, all inclusive, sustainable prosperity. And something really cool, when you put that together, it spells career dharma. Just like totally. Okay, so we're going to look at the first thing, identifying our prosperity type and career field, and the first principle, connecting our nature with our livelihood. So now, many times, maybe most of the time, when people think about what work they want to do, they think in terms of what's going to make the most money. Do you have a successful career? Are you prosperous? And people will think in terms of money. And everybody needs money. I'm not denying everybody. I need money. I can't buy shoes with a smile. You know, you have to have some money. But I wonder, I'd like to ask all of you, have you ever met anyone, heard of anybody who didn't have a whole lot of money but had a very fulfilling life, a rich life, one could say? How many of you have ever heard of, met such a person? Now, I'd like to ask if you've ever heard of, read about, met anybody who had a lot of money, but they didn't have a very happy life. They had kind of a poor life. How many of you have ever heard of such a person? If you haven't, I'd suggest you look at any headlines in any news, and you'll find some fabulously rich person who's unhappy. So although certainly money is a factor, if we really want to have prosperity in our work, we would do well to look at what's called our prosperity types. So there's 6 of these explained in the Vedic wisdom literature, like the Bhagavad Purana. And each of us have 1, 2, or 3 of these that are really essential for us to feel that we have prosperity. By the way, I gave these PowerPoints to Baba Sundi, and she can share them widely with everybody. And if you also, I mean, you're welcome to take pictures too, I don't mind. But if any of you want copies directly, you can ask her, you can ask me, and I will. Or if you pop right after the class with the flash drive, I'll just give them to you anyway. And if you want to go ahead and teach this to other people, I'd be thrilled. So each of us have one, two, or maybe three, maybe four. Usually it's one, two, or three of these. That if we're not getting this from our work, we do not feel rich. Now, people might think, well, I can just get money and then I'll buy these things. But that doesn't always work. You can't always exchange one kind of richness for another. Like if I change US dollars to New Zealand dollars and then change them back to US dollars, what will happen? I'm going to lose, right? And when you try to exchange one type of prosperity for another, you end up being not satisfied. Or some people think, well, I'll just get money when I work, and then I'll get my prosperity types in the evenings or the weekends. But we don't always have that much time on the evenings or the weekends. And who wants to spend 8 hours a day feeling impoverished? So we're going to go through these rather quickly. We did have a full two-hour class on this, which I think was recorded. And we do have a whole chapter in the book. So if you want to go more deeply, you can access those. As we go through these, I'm going to be asking you to think of what was your experience when you had them and what was your experience when you didn't have them as part of your work. How did they make you? How did it make you feel? So the first is Aishwarya, which comes from what Sanskrit word? Ishwar. It has to do with being a controller, being a leader. But this is having to do with being a leader in an administrative, positional sense, where you actually have some people that you're like managing and directing, you're organizing things. Yes, so there's many of us that thrive on this kind of prosperity. We really enjoy taking leadership roles and helping other people to be successful and bringing together people with different talents and abilities and leading teams and so forth. Yeah? It really makes us feel enriched. And then there's other people who really don't want to do this. They just want to do their own work, maybe just work as part of a team, but they really don't want to be taking some administrative role and leading other people and so forth. So I'd like you to think about the times in your life when you've had Aishwarya and the times when you haven't had it, particularly as part of your work. And what does it feel like when you have it? And what does it feel like when you don't have it? Then the next is Gyan. Gyan means knowledge. And some of us have work where we have to keep learning. Can you see the screen from there? Like I once talked to a doctor who told me that she had to read at least 3 articles in her field every week to stay current in her profession. So there's many of us that we need to have that in our work to feel enriched. Where part of our work is maybe researching or learning and constantly adding to our knowledge base. And other people really don't like that. Like, I already finished school. Why do I have to keep studying? Why do I have to keep taking trainings? Why do I have to keep taking courses? So again, I'd like you to think about when you've had Gyan as an integral part of your work, or times when you haven't had it, and how do you feel when you have it? I don't mind babies as long as they're not screaming, but is that okay with everybody? Is everyone okay with just like little happy baby noises? Some people find them very distracting. So I'd like you to think about when you've had Gyan part of your work and when you haven't had it, how do you feel when you have it and how do you feel when you don't have it? Thank you. So the next is virya. Virya has to do with strength and health. So there's a lot of work where the work itself makes you physically stronger and healthier. Like work that involves a lot of physicality. You know, you're building buildings, you're dancing, you're working out in the outside. You know, something where the work itself is making you healthy. Like the work is like a gym. You understand? Or in some way the work is adding to your health. Maybe part of your work involves eating healthy foods or being in some kind of an environment that's contributing to your health. And for some people, this is essential in order to feel enriched. You know, I know people who say, you know, well, the best part of my work is that I get to be outside and I get to be lifting heavy things and doing a lot of movement. And other people find this annoying to have as part of their work. You know, they're happy to get their exercise in the evenings and the weekends or the early morning. And as far as their work, they'd find that annoying if they had to be very physical. Now, again, we're not talking about when you're giving this prosperity type to others. For example, some doctors help other people to become healthy, but their own work isn't making them healthy. Yeah? I remember once being in a doctor's office and I saw that there was a snack room and in the vending machine it was full of all junk food. Okay. Or, you know, they may keep long hours and stuff like that. So we're thinking about when this is coming as part of your work for yourself. So if you can think of when your work helped you achieve virya, when it didn't, how do you feel when you have that as part of your work? How do you feel when you don't have it? So the next is Shri. Shri has to do with anything that quite glitter and shines. Anything that's beautiful. So this can be visual beauty, auditory beauty, olfactory beauty, the beauty of nature. It can also mean charismatic leadership, which is a little different from Aishwarya. Aishwarya is positional leadership. You actually have a title, you have a position, you have some administrative duties. So you might have both Aishwarya and Shri in terms of leadership. Some people are both administrative leaders and charismatic leadership. But you could be a charismatic leader without having any administrative duties or administrative responsibilities. Does that make sense? So Shri would apply to any of those things in your work. Maybe you have work where you're dealing with a lot of music. Or maybe you have work where you work outside in beautiful natural environments. Or maybe you work with perfumes and incense and different sorts of wonderful smells or flowers. Or maybe you work with artwork or dance or something that involves things that are very visually beautiful. Or maybe you have some situation of charismatic leadership or some kind of combination of those. Now, some people really need this as part of their work in order to feel enriched. We'll have time. And for others of us, we find this annoying. So there's people who, they just want things to be practical, and they feel that having to make things beautiful is an annoyance. Like, I mean, they don't mind if other people want to make it beautiful, that's cool. But it's not something that really, that they want to have to do as part of their work. So I'd like, again, for you to think of when you've had this as part of your work, when you haven't had any aspect of Shri, how do you feel when you have it? How do you feel when you don't have it? So next is Yasha. Yasha is actually a person whose parents were called Kirti and Shri, Kirti and Dharma, rather. So Kirti means to talk about, it's related to the word kirtan, and Dharma means that which is authentic, or that which is good. And so when people talk about you because you've done good things, that is Yasha. Not just that people are talking about you, but they're talking about you for something that's authentic and something that's valuable. And having Yasha implies a community. It's a little different than the charismatic leadership of Sri. You know, the charismatic leadership of Sri, you might be the person who gets on top of a stage, and but you're not really necessarily in a community where people are giving you appreciation and acknowledgement on a regular basis. So Yasha means you have some work where it's involving you in some sort of supportive, appreciative community. Now, for a lot of people, Yasha is essential to having a rich life in their work. In fact, I know some people who can't even work without it at all. I've met some people that if you say, hey, this is your job, can you go get it done? Nothing happens. And if you say, hey, this is your job and your team, can you get it done with your team? Then all of a sudden everything happens. Yeah. And then there's others of us who again find this annoying. It's like, can't I just get my work done? Why do I have to deal with this group? And why do we have to have an appreciation dinner? And, so, you know, if you can think of, again, if when you've had Yasha as part of your work or when you haven't had it, how do you feel when you have it and how do you feel when you don't have it? The last is vairagya, which may seem to some people as an anti-prosperity, but it is another way of feeling enriched and prosperous, and this is about equanimity and freedom and detachment. So some of us really like to have work that has a tremendous amount of freedom and detachment built into it. Maybe something where we have flexible schedules, or something where we can do a lot of travel, or something where we're not dealing with social-emotional stuff, or something where we're dealing a lot in areas that require tremendous amounts of forgiveness and equanimity and compassion, or where we can lead a very minimalistic lifestyle. And other people don't like this at all. There's other people who are much more interested in security and regulation and being able to have more luxuries in life, and they're just really not comfortable with this at all. So again, I'd like you to think about when you've had vairagya built into your work, and when you haven't had it, how do you feel when you have it, and how do you feel when you don't have it? So you're all pretty much been able to find one, two, or maybe three of these that you're like, I really need that. And if I don't have that, what's nice about this list is it gives you much more flexible information about what kind of specific careers would be suitable for you. And I'll just give you a very simple example. There's a good friend of mine who used to work as a traveling musician. He and his wife would travel from one city to the next in a little van, and he would unload their equipment and load it back up again. And they wrote their own music, and he usually wrote kind of philosophical lyrics, although the way the music was, you couldn't figure out what the lyrics were when you were listening to it. And his wife also did dance numbers with the music, and they had light shows and things like that. Okay, so from his work, he was getting vairagya. He was traveling, right, with very, very little. He was getting Sri from the music, he was getting Virya, taking that equipment in and out, and a little bit again from working on the lyrics to his music. So the job he does now is quite different. He is a guide in national parks in America, so he travels from one park to another, and he studies the history, the plant life, the animal life of the farm, of the park. He usually checks out the past beforehand, you know, figures out everything. And then he takes people on like 1 hour or one day or sometimes multi-day with camping trips through the national parks. So he's still vairagya. He's still traveling, very, very simple, very austere. He still gets Sri, but there's the beauty of nature instead of music. He's getting actually a lot more virya, hiking through the parks all the time, and even a little bit more jnana as he's studying about the nature of the parks. So you might look at those two jobs and say that they're radically different. But he's getting essentially the same types of prosperity. Okay. So anyone have any quick questions about the prosperity types? I think you had something, yeah?
Yeah, just the Shri, you mentioned smell, sight, and hearing, or like the other senses. Would a cook who likes to make the food also be Shri?
Yeah, it would be. Yes?
Can you give an example of charismatic leadership without organizational leadership?
Sure. Let's say that you're a motivational speaker, but you don't run an organization at all. You're not in charge of anybody. Yeah?
Could it be that someone has avyasha, just meritorious fame, or just the community aspect, or is it both?
Well, if your community isn't supporting you and admiring you and recognizing you, that might actually be kind of depressing. The point is that yasha is not really referring to fame without a community. That would be charismatic leadership. You know, there's a lot of famous people in the world where they're very well known, but they don't necessarily have people who are giving them support. That's quite a different thing. Does that make sense? Yeah, but not just working in teams that are focused on the work, but working in teams that are also emotionally and socially supportive. Do you follow the difference? Like, I've worked on teams where the entire focus is work. You have, you know, very, very little personal type relationship with anyone. You're working synergistically to get the work done, but that's different when you have some group that's actually supporting each other and giving each other recognition and admiration and, yeah? Yes?
So these types of prosperity sort of fade in and out. Say if you're an Aishvarya, but you're 17 years old, you've got the angst of a 17-year-old, or you've got major midlife crisis that sort of changes your prosperity type, or does it just sort of get hidden by life's
motion? Maybe they get hidden sometimes, but we tend to have a consistent nature. Yes?
Are there prosperity types that seem more complementary to one another?
Yes.
There are some that are not.
Yes, there are, but that doesn't necessarily hold true for a particular individual. We're interesting folks. And sometimes you have a person whose prosperity types appear to be contradictory. That happens actually quite often. Although there are some of these that sort of naturally fit together. But that doesn't mean that an individual is going to have that at all. Okay? Yes? As I say, we do have a whole, I think it's chapter 2, that we have in the book that we discuss this in depth. And we have, maybe, could you hand me a non-wrapped up book? Yeah. So we have yes, this is chapter 2, and then our appendix A, which is on page 499. Sure. Yes, on page 499 we have an exercise where we describe different types of work, and then you try to figure out what prosperity type they're getting, and then we have the answers with explanations. And those of you who want to later, you might want to get together with some other people who are doing this and work on it together. We were doing this with a group I was teaching really, really in depth in the Govardhan Eco Village outside of Mumbai, and people were spending like an hour working together through these exercises. So you might, any of you who are interested in going deeper, you might want to do that. Okay, now we're going to go on to another way of understanding our nature in terms of career. And this is explained by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita and throughout all of the Vedic literatures. And these are the four fields of work. Now, unlike the prosperity type, each of us has only one field. And these fields have mutually exclusive values and dharma. So my co-author, Dr. Datta, and I, we were really looking deeply at why traditionally all the hundreds of thousands of work are divided into these four categories. Why these four categories? What would be the value of that for people? Well, one reason is that these four ways of understanding work always exist in human society. You know, individual jobs might not, like there haven't always been software engineers. You know, different specific careers come and go. The demand for certain careers rises and falls in different areas. But these fields remain constant. Also, these fields represent different inclinations towards what feels right, what feels authentic, what is driving us. And as I say, they're mutually exclusive. If we think about parts of the body, you know, the work of the heart is vastly different to the work of the lungs. Now, both the heart and the lungs are distributing something within the body, right? Blood, and then there's the oxygen and so forth. But their work is still very different. The nature of the cells in those two organs is very different, and they're not interchangeable. You can't say, well, sometimes I'm going to be a cell in the lung, and another time I'm going to be a cell in the heart. You know, it just doesn't work that way. So each of us is like that. What is our value? What is our driver? Is going to be in one of these fields. Now, as we discuss this, some of you may think, well, I think I'm in more than one field. Generally, what that means is either you're just a little confused, which is very common at the present time, for people to be a little confused, or you're in one field that particularly assists another field. So you might be working in government, but you particularly assist artistry, or you're working in ideas, but you particularly assist resources. So you might be solidly in one field, but you have interest in particularly helping another field. So we're going to go relatively briefly through an explanation of the nature of the fields and the nature of the people in the fields. And I put a little cheat sheet here on the whiteboard. So we have two chapters in the book on this. We have one on the nature of the fields itself. Which is chapter 3. And then the nature of the people in the fields, which is chapter 4. And I gave more in-depth classes on this, which have been recorded and are available here in the community and also on my YouTube channel, if you would like to go more deeply into this. Okay, first we're going to look at the field of artistry. The field of artistry provides all of the beauty and function in society. These are the careers that make everything work. Without these jobs, really nothing would function. They provide all the support in society and all the beauty and pleasures of society. You can kind of think of them metaphorically as being all the salt and spices in the food. You know, without this field, everything would just be plain, unsalted rice kind of thing. You know. The people that are, the temperament of the people in this field is that they're naturally satisfied. These people are not very ambitious. They don't really care, unless they're pushed on by outside sources, they don't really care about making a lot of money and being big and successful in the world. They care about making the world beautiful and supportive. Their mood is that of service. And in that way, actually, the temperament of the people in this field is the closest to the ideal of bhakti yoga, which is where one gets one's satisfaction from serving Krishna, from serving the Supreme. So that's the mood in artistry. The mood in artistry is my pleasure comes from serving a client, serving a customer. I'll paint a beautiful painting that will hang in someone else's house. I'll fix the plumbing in someone else's house. I'll cook a meal that someone else will eat. And my pleasure is in their pleasure. The people in this field, if they're treated with respect and dignity and fairness and integrity, if they're paid a fair price for their goods or services, and if they have enough so that they can have a comfortable house, good food, decent clothes to wear, loving people in their family, and they can have quality in their craft, they're satisfied. They uphold the status quo in society. They're the foundation people. The main questions they ask about their work are, is it beautiful? Is it supportive? Can anybody tell me some possible careers in this field? And getting it wrong is great. If you get this wrong, you'll know what it's not. So that's as much a learning experience as getting it right. Yes? Very few teachers. If you're teaching people like how to ice a cake or how to change a tire, yes, but otherwise, no.
Builders.
Builders, yes. Not the people who own the construction company, but the people who go and build stuff, yes.
Software engineers.
All engineers, yes.
Cooks.
Cooks, yes. Yes. Yes, customer service, receptionists, secretaries, yes. Yes.
Musicians?
Almost all, not all, but almost all musicians.
I'm wondering where doctors, nurses, and healers come
from. Okay, nurses are in this field. Doctors that are surgeons and dentists are generally in this field because they're kind of like plumbers or electricians. But other medical workers are not in this field. House painters, yes. And if they're fine art painters, most. Not all, but most. Yes?
Designers?
Like web designers, interior designers, clothing designers, yes. Yes?
Sports players?
Yes, professional athletes. Yes.
Actors?
Most actors, not all, but most.
Dancers?
Huh?
Dancers.
Dancers, most dancers. Not all, but most.
Infantry?
No.
Generic soldier?
No. Military? No. Again, wrong answers are just as valuable as right answers.
Astronaut.
Astronaut.
I was thinking, because
well,
it's
Astronauts. What do astronauts do? Are they scientists?
They go to space.
You know, when I was 6 years old, I still remember we had a writing assignment. John Glenn went to space. John Glenn went to space. We all wrote that when I was in first grade. It was my handwriting assignment. Yeah. But what did they do up in space? Are they mostly researchers and scientists in space? Or are they engineers? Okay, well, some of them who are just engineers are in this field, but if they're scientists, then no.
Oh, they take photos
of probably some of these people in the spacecraft are in artistry if they're engineers. But if they're doing scientific research in space, then no. Very rarely. That would be very unusual. If all you're teaching is some simple craft, then yes. You know, you're a plumber and you're training some apprentice in plumbing, then yes. And generally, when there are teachers in artistry, that's not the main thing they do. Like, mostly they're doing plumbing, but they may also teach some plumbing on the side. Yeah, but generally, teachers are not in this field. Okay. Now, it's interesting because of the service attitude of this field. Sometimes people outside the field see this work as being kind of low level, isn't it? You know, a lot of this. And it's interesting, or people sometimes have a prejudice that people in this field don't make a lot of money. Although, at least in America, there are many plumbers who make more money than college professors. Right? And many engineers are, for example, very highly educated or very intelligent. So there are many people in this field that are highly educated, that are highly intelligent, or that make a lot of money. But sometimes there's kind of a prejudice about this field that all these are like the lower jobs in society. You understand? Yeah? And what's really unfortunate is sometimes we treat people in this field like that. And we forget that the real satisfaction for those who work in artistry is pleasing their customer and their client. Not making money. They're satisfied people. And I've seen someone, you know, someone comes and cleans their house for them and they just pay them and walk away and they think that's not what they're living for. And you want to be able to say, hey, you know, I really, really like the way you clean the stairs. I saw you got in the corners and thank you for making the world more beautiful. Thank you for making the world work nicely. Right. And also this is a field of honesty. Now, the particular type of honesty in this field is interesting because they do want to please the customer or the client, but they're very honest in representing their goods or services. For example, if you're going to buy plumbing in a shop, you might pay $200 for pipe that the shop owner paid $100 for, right? And they're not going to tell you that. They're not going to say, I've doubled the price here for my, otherwise you won't buy it. But when you hire a plumber, at least the people I've worked with who have the dharma of this field, they might even show you the receipts for the pipe. This is what I paid for the pipe, here's the receipts, and this is what I'm charging for my labor. Right? You follow what I'm saying? And you don't want to work with a dishonest electrician. I mean, it would really be a problem. So you have this satisfaction and this honesty and this direct service for people in the mood of an assistant. All right. Let's go on to the field of ideas. The field of ideas gives wisdom and guidance and truth to society. Here is where we have most of the teaching that goes on, and counseling and guidance, helping in ritual and worship. You could say this is the field that provides the vision for society, the guidance for society as a whole. Now, people in this field usually work with language, writing, speaking, but sometimes it's with mathematics. Some people are teaching truth and wisdom through mathematics, and some of the people in this field are using the fine arts. So that's why you have some artists, some musicians, some actors, some dancers who are in the field of ideas. It's a minority, but there are some. So if someone's singing, you know, oh, my baby's gone, that's artistry, right? But if you have people that are singing about truth and wisdom and the aesthetics part of it is secondary, that's ideas. Now, the vast majority of the intellectuals of society are in this field, but not everyone in this field is an intellectual. It's like, if it's raining, there has to be clouds, but if there's clouds, there might not be rain. So if you're an intellectual, you're probably in the field of ideas, but if you're in the field of ideas, you might not at all be an intellectual. There are many careers in the field of ideas that do not involve being an intellectual. And there are intelligent people in all four fields. Intelligence in and of itself is not simply in the field of ideas. The field of ideas, like the field of artistry, is a field of satisfaction. The people in this field are not ambitious. They're not interested in doing expansive things and making a lot of money and that kind of thing. Their satisfaction is quite different from that of artistry, however. What they're satisfied with is a very active mental and intellectual life. They're not interested in pleasing customers and clients, and they may not even be very interested in the basic creature comforts of life. If they have a comfortable home and good food and good clothing, that may be okay, but that's not really the main source of their satisfaction. The main source of their satisfaction is what's going on internally. So they're also a satisfied field like artistry, but for very different reasons. And like artistry, they're a field of honesty, but it's a very different kind of honesty than in the field of artistry. So the field of artistry, you're honest about how much you paid for the pipe and how much the work is going to cost and what pipe does what kind of job. But in ideas, you have a straightforwardness about you. You're going to speak the truth even if it displeases others. You follow? So in artistry, you want to please your customer or client. In ideas, I'm just going to tell you the truth, you know. Hey, you've got cancer, you've got to stop smoking. That's not going to please your patient, right? But you're going to speak the unvarnished truth. Artistry is providing the support in the status quo. In ideas, they'll challenge the status quo. They'll say, wait, this is wrong. This has to be fixed. Ideas is the most abstract. Oh, I didn't put that line here. I put these up in order of abstraction. Ideas is the most abstract, and artistry is the most concrete. Like, what is a table? It's very concrete, right? It's not abstract. What is philosophy? What is religion? What is wisdom? It's very abstract. You follow? Yes? So ideas is the most abstract, and artistry is the most concrete. And the main questions that people and ideas have about their work are, is it true and is it wise? Now, people outside the field of ideas often think a lot of the work in ideas is useless. Why are you studying the eating habits of an endangered bear in northern Canada? What good does that do for anybody? Or why are you, you know, looking at the poetic ornamentation of, you know, Sri Rupa Goswami's poems? Like, the dishes that need to be washed. Bills that need to be paid. So it's often people look at it and see that it's useless. Also, often people look at workers in the field of ideas and see them as being arrogant. Because people in the field of ideas tend to be kind of detached and unsentimental. Like in artistry, you're serving people directly as an assistant. In ideas, you tend to be a little detached from the world and unsentimental. And people may think, oh, you think you're better than everybody else. What are some possible careers in the field of ideas? Yes? Well, if you're not detached, you can't teach objective truth. It's not possible. Those are incompatible. Yes?
Which one is the one that you don't?
Hopefully that'll be very obvious. But I'm much more interested in all of you figuring out what you do. I already know what I do. Yes?
Scientist.
Huh? Scientist, yes.
Accountant.
Huh? An accountant. No, thank you for a wrong answer. Now, if all an accountant is doing is just adding up money, then they're going to be in artistry. But you do have accountants who are actually like financial managers, and they're in another field. Yes?
Psychologists,
yes. Yes?
Any kind of research?
Yes, research, yes. Not any kind, but mostly, almost all research, yes.
Priests,
yes. Philosophers, yes. Teachers, yes. Almost all teachers are.
Writers?
Huh?
Writers?
Depends what you're writing. So if you're writing romance novels and detective novels, or even if it's nonfiction, you know, if you're writing, what's some movie? Tom Cruise, right? If you're writing, you know, the biography of Tom Cruise, that's in artistry. Right? But if you're writing about wisdom and truth, and inside, that's an idea. Same with journalism. So if you're writing the gossip column, right, that's in artistry. If you're a war correspondent in Ukraine or Israel, that's in ideas.
Propagandist.
That sounds awful. But no, that's not this field. Because is a propagandist giving objective truth? No. Yes?
A historian.
Are you studying history and teaching history?
What if they were just... I suppose so.
Yes, then that would be...
What about software, which seems like between ideas and artistry?
Well, engineers use science. but they're not scientists. They're not contributing to the truth and wisdom of the world. They're creating to the beauty and functionality of the world. Although they use science. And they, many engineers work as assistants to, scientists. So there you have the situation where you're working in one field, particularly assisting another field. So engineers may work very closely with scientists. Or they may use, they're taking a lot of the things from science and putting into practical application for functionality in the world.
Some companies might hire scientists to work in the software company while also having engineers working in the software company.
That's correct.
Have them work together?
Yes. Yes. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. It's not that everybody in one company is in the same field. In fact, you can have all four fields working in a company. We have a few diagrams here of different organizations and how you can have people in the different four fields working together. Our eighth principle talks about how the fields interrelate with each other.
Where would you place someone like Shakespeare, just to go back onto writers who obviously is writing over a moment?
I would put him in artistry.
In artistry?
Yes. He's mostly adding to the pleasure of the world. I mean, people who produce things, everyone wants to produce something that has meaning, and we'll get to that in one of our other principles. If in artistry you're producing pleasure without meaning, that's not dharmic. Does that make sense? A dharmic person in the field of artistry, they want their music, their painting, their theater, their dance to be inspiring to people and uplift people. But they're doing that primarily through pleasure rather than through wisdom directly. Now, there may be some wisdom in what they're doing, but their main contribution to society is not directly wisdom. Does that make sense? Yes.
A swami.
A swami is supposed to be someone who's civilly dead. Dead people don't have careers. So, no, seriously, really, really seriously.
Isn't it like a spiritual
career move? It certainly should not be. If it is, that's, you've got a real problem. That is a serious problem. And like, guru is not a livelihood. Anyone in any of the four fields can be a spiritual guru. But a swami isn't an order of life. You know, traditionally, people generally became swamis at the very end of life. That they died before dying. They would usually become swamis when they're like 75, 80 years old. So someone who takes up an order of sannyas, they become civilly dead. They no longer have a career in the world. And someone who wants to have a career in the world shouldn't become a swami. Now, they still have their nature, which they may engage in some kind of service, but not as any kind of a life. Is that okay? We'll actually touch on that very briefly later. We have a whole chapter in the book about the life cycle, which would be ashram dharma, the life cycle and how that relates to career.
I meant it in the way, isn't it kind of like leadership though, if they make centers and make outreach places like farms and stuff? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, in that sense, kind of? Or is it not? Or like the kind of people who manage those places?
Do you want to talk about what people do or what should be?
Oh, I meant an idea. I'm confused.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I'm not talking about what you look around and happening in the world at this moment, but we're talking about what is the ideal system as set forth by Krishna for society.
Oh, I'm just confused.
Are you still confused?
Yes.
Okay. Taking sannyas, becoming a swami, means that you've died to society, that you no longer have any kind of family or career within society. That's what it means. That you're only dedicated to spiritual pursuits and not to doing anything in the world.
Yep.
Is that always what happens? No, but that is the ideal of what should happen.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, does that mean that a sannyasi should be teaching about Krishna consciousness and not about the things to do with material life?
Well, no, because because we're not one-sided, like the Ishopanishad says.
So in what sense are they not?
It's not their means of livelihood. They don't have a means of livelihood.
But they still have duties, but it's not to do with their livelihood.
The duties are quite different. What are their duties? Fearlessness, purification of existence. Everybody has some duties.
Are they not the... are they not meant to teach wisdom to the rest of society?
But to people who are retired and people who are renunciates are meant to share wisdom, yes. But they're not sharing wisdom as a professional teacher. They don't have a livelihood.
There's a householder who is a teacher.
Yes.
Does it as a livelihood.
Correct. Exactly. Can you understand the distinction? It is actually quite a distinction. Yes?
So can, based on that, can a sannyasi, if they can share wisdom without any remuneration, can they also do like other, like government resource activity without remuneration?
They really should not. And they're not teaching like a teacher is teaching. Okay? At least they're not supposed to be. Again, we have people, that happens, but what's supposed to happen ideally is, you know, like Srila Prabhupada, who was a sannyasi, he wasn't acting like a college professor. Do you follow what I'm saying? And certainly sannyasi should not be in the field of government or in the field of resources, in the field of artistry. It's not where they belong. And they don't even belong in the field of ideas. They're not there as doing that as their profession. I mean, they maintain themselves by begging and giving spiritual knowledge. Whatever they get. Again, traditionally, sannyasi is something you take at the end of life when you're preparing to depart the world. You die before dying, and you die before dying so that death has no sting. I mean, even on a simple, on something circumstantially perhaps, with my mother, so in the last year of her life, she moved into a nursing home. She gave away all of her possessions to her family and friends. She sold her apartment. I mean, the only thing she had when she died was one painting and a chair and a little box of clothes. It was very nice for me, as the next, I didn't have anything to do. You know, I speak to so many people, they say it took me a year to go through my parents' house and take care of everything. I literally had nothing to do. She had prepaid her funeral. She had pre-written her obituary that was in the New York Times. I mean, it was like, seriously. You know, the limo picked me up for the funeral 2 days later. I just had to go home. She had died before dying, you follow? And she would say, better to give everything with a warm hand than a cold hand. I mean, she had to die with some money because you didn't know how long she was going to live, obviously. But, yeah, that's the actual idea of sannyasis like that. That you die before dying. That you let go of all these things. And this was for those of you who are familiar, some of you aren't going to know what I'm talking about. But just like in the Bhagavad Purana, there's a story of a great king, Bharat. And he becomes a renunciate and he goes to the forest. And there he sees a deer had a miscarriage and there was this little infant deer and he hadn't given up the mood on the king, on the protector. And it was his downfall. It wasn't his job anymore. And because it wasn't his job anymore, he got completely entangled, and it really damaged him. That one, you know, we have throughout, especially the Bhagavad Purana, all these people who hold responsible positions, and they come to a point where they say, no, you know, I'm not. I'm finished with that. You know, we have a, I don't want to talk too much about ashram dharma. We have some semblance of this in modern society, like my mother going into a nursing home. I mean, we have, you know, people get to a point where they retire from work and they travel to, but they usually travel to like Disney World or Antarctica or something like that. You know, and then we have a time also when people, especially they get close to death, where they step back from everything. Yeah? I understand. Like, I remember when I visited my mother in her last weeks and she was watching the news, and I said, why are you watching the news? I said, you're leaving. You don't need to know what's going on anymore. And so she stopped. She just said, okay, fine. If you're working in the world, you need to know what's going on in the world, right? Yeah? Is that all right? Yeah?
Are brahmacharis also the same?
Sort of, kind of. You guys are really like jumping ahead here to principle two. Brahmachari, the ideas, so you're jumping. So, okay, you know what, since you're all jumping, I'm just going to jump there for a minute and then I'll jump back, okay? So when you're young, you should be trained, and you should be trained in your career. That's what schooling is for, what education is for. Like Prabhupada wrote, the Brahmachari Ashram is for training in values of life along with specific training for a livelihood. People should notice what your proclivities are, notice what your inclinations are, and train you in them. Then when you're in the prime of life, that's when you work in career. That's when you want to. That's when you want to, you know, you want to affect the world and change the world and help the world and do things for others and be active in the world, and you have that energy to do that. And then you retire. There's a concept in every culture of retirement. Then you retire. And then you can guide others, but you're not actively working in your career anymore. And then at the final time, you prepare for death. So the only time you're actually working in your field is in the prime of life. Now, your basic nature is still there, and when you're retired or when you're older, you might use that nature in some kind of charitable way and voluntary work, but you're no longer working for a livelihood. Is that right? Okay. And when I get to this slide in order, I won't have anything to say. Okay, clear about the field of ideas? I think this was important because a lot of times people do equate the work of the field of ideas with spiritual renunciates, and it's not. Although priests are in this field. Yeah, like our dear friend Prana, you know, he was a teacher, he was a professional teacher, and he also did a lot of priestly activities. I remember when I was staying in that cottage next door to you, and he and his wife came and said, we paid for all the furniture here from the donation we got doing our priestly activities. Do you remember that? Yeah. Okay. Anything else about the field of ideas? Yes?
Is there any, what kind of research doesn't fall into the field of ideas?
Well, let's take a data analyst. Okay, so when I was teaching this at Lloyds Bank in London, one of the people who was there was a data analyst. And I said, so what do you do? He said, well, I work with a team and we collect raw data. We statistically analyze it, then we decide what it means, and then we make recommendations to the bank. I said, do you choose what data to gather? He said, yes. I said, analyzing it is pretty simple. You know what statistical tests to use for what kind of data. Like, I mean, it takes some discrimination, but it's not that complicated. And I said, and you're also interpreting this data, saying what it means, what it implies, and giving advice. He says, yes. That's in the field of ideas. But I met someone else who's a data analyst a few months later, and he said, no, we're told what data to collect. And all we do is collect the data we're told to collect, and then we put it through the statistical software. I said, do you interpret it? He said, no. I said, do you give any advice on it? He said, no. What field is that in?
Arts.
So you might look at him and say he's a researcher, but not really. No, but the vast majority of researchers, yes. Yes?
What about, so because I'm this cross, and the ideas of government, in the sense that policy...
I haven't discussed government yet. No, wait! Wait! Otherwise you're going to jump ahead of people who haven't heard that, so just wait. We'll get there. Okay? Okay, I really want to move on because it's 7:15. Okay, let's go to the field, and we have a lot more to go, like a lot. So looking at the field of resources provides all the resources for society. These are the people who make sure society has food and building materials and fibers and raw materials for medicines. Often they work with the natural resources. They may be growing cotton, or they may be shearing sheep. Right? Or they may be growing wheat, or they may be growing rice. Or they may be just working with money. And these people, their mentality is that they're always thirsty. This is an expansive field. That's what it says in the Bhagavatam. Literally, it says they're always thirsty. This is a field of expansion. It has to be a field of expansion because these are the people that feed the world. If all they cared about was their own garden and they were satisfied, we would all starve. Okay? They are expansive. The main questions they ask about their work are, is it sustainable and is it regenerative? They want to make sure that we're eating not only this season, but next season and next year. So what they do is they have to save the seeds from the harvest, otherwise there's nothing to plant next year. There has to be, in other words, a profit. This is very much misunderstood by people outside of the field as greediness or selfishness. But it's not. It's the means by which they're able to keep things sustainable and regenerative. The people in this field are the main employers in human society. People in artistry, government, and ideas do employ others, but definitely resources is the biggest employer. They pay the bulk of the taxes. They pay the bulk of the charity. They're the main people who are amassing wealth in society and making society wealthy. There's also some duplicity inherent in this field, some diplomacy, you could say. Just like, as I said, you walk into a business, they don't tell you their profit margin. If they did, you wouldn't buy anything there. Right? You wouldn't say, well, I think that's fair. So there has to, also in this field, people don't always represent their goods and services honestly. Do we expect advertisement to be honest? Not at all. See, we expect plumbers to be honest, and we expect scientists to be honest, but we don't expect business people to be honest. They're going to bring out, well, this is the value of our particular product. Their ethics is to provide sustainable, regenerative wealth for society. So our youngest son is in this field, and I remember him saying to me, he was in his 20s, he said, you know, by the time I was in my early 20s, I had generated more wealth for society than was spent on me growing up. And he said, that's my aim for my own children, that they'll contribute more wealth to society than we're investing in them. That is the dharma of this field. And they're looking at the flows of resources in society. They know how to make money when things are going up. They know how to make money when things are going down. They know how to produce food when there's rain, when there's not rain, when there's pestilence, when there's not pestilence. They understand what are the competitors. They understand what are the needs of the market. So in that way, although they're also dealing, like artistry, with practical things, they're more abstract than artistry. And like ideas, they're an unsentimental field. They know that in order to feed people, they have to make a profit. Otherwise, things are not going to go on. Okay, some ideas of careers in this field?
CEO.
A CEO of a business, yes. Yes?
Does this include all retailers?
Yeah, all retail shops. Not the clerks in the shop. Not like the salespeople.
Entrepreneurs,
yes.
Farmers,
if they own the farm. The people who work for them, no. Yes?
Transport and logistics.
Yes. But not the truck drivers. Yeah?
Banks,
yes. But not the tellers. But the people who own the banks, the investment bankers, stockbrokers, financial advisors, like that. Okay?
What about accountants?
Accountants.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you're a financial advisor, a financial manager, your resources, if you're just doing the accounts, then you're an artistry. Depends, you know, how... Yes. If you're just working as an assistant, just crunching the numbers and giving out a report, this is what you spend. That's really interesting, and Dr. Dutch and I have talked a lot about HR managers and where they fit. It seems that they mostly are doing government-type work. By the way, this is something that we've been discussing for quite a while. Okay, let's go on to the field of government. So as soon as you have anything more than a simple society, you need to have some kind of organization. You need to have somebody who makes laws, who enforces laws, who provides for protection against internal and external threats, who makes sure people are dealt with fairly, who makes sure there's proper distribution of resources, and who arranges for services on a large scale that people can't take care of themselves. You know, it's not like everyone's going to build their own little piece of the road in front of their house. So, you know, maintaining the roads and the parks and the schools and the hospitals and all that kind of stuff. Now, this field of government does not apply only to political governments. But it also applies to people who do government-type work on a very small scale as a landlord, like your apartment building is your little kingdom. And you collect rent and you make people sure people have a parking space and water and electricity and everything they need and a playground. And it also can apply to things like the UN, NATO, Interpol, and sometimes to charitable, what we ironically call non-government organizations, that do government-type work. Now, most of those organizations exist because the political government isn't fully doing their job. And so they're filling in a gap, doing government-type work with charity. So these are the protectors of human society, but also the caregivers of human society. Like artistry, they're serving people directly, but they're serving more like a parent would serve rather than an assistant. Now, this is also an expansive field. You want to take care of a lot of people in big ways. And this is also a field of diplomacy. If the politicians told us what they were actually, how little they were actually going to do, we would never vote for them. Right? We just wouldn't. And if they went to the other governments and said, you know, we really don't like you guys, you kind of stink, and then there's a war. And in fact, one of the government jobs is to be a diplomat. And so this is a field of diplomacy rather than honesty. And the questions they ask about their work are, is it just and is it honorable? And these are the running toward danger people. The epitome of this field is a firefighter. And I want to think of like who epitomizes government as a firefighter. Buildings on fire, they're running in, everybody else is running out. Okay, other careers that are in government. Soldiers, all military. Not the cooks in the military.
Lawyers,
yes. Yeah?
Judicial system?
Yes, the judicial, but not the clerks.
Journalists.
Journalists know in ideas.
Propagandists.
Propagandists, yes, there's where they belong. Propagandists, speechwriters, political speechwriters, yes.
Paramedics.
Paramedics. They're probably in, those are probably in artistry, like nurses.
Police.
Not sure about paramedics, because often paramedics work with firefighters and with police, and are they're running into danger people. So maybe.
Civil rights campaigners.
Is that their job?
Some people seem to make that.
If that's their job, yes. Yes. If someone has a job where they're working for justice and morals and ethics, yes.
Can you make an argument for CEO in some cases?
No. No. And that we'll look at in a few minutes about crossing fields. Now, if somebody with the mentality of government is a CEO, that's a problem.
Lawyers?
Lawyers, yes.
What about fundraising for an NGO like Greenpeace?
About what?
A fundraiser for an NGO like Greenpeace or UNICEF or something like that.
If the NGO is doing government-type work, yeah, then those people are working in government. I mean, they have some assistance there in artistry, and, yeah.
So the fundraising might be in artistry.
Fundraising, interestingly enough, according to scripture, is actually a career in the field of ideas. So traditionally, charitable organizations were not in government. So traditionally, government got money from taxes, fines, or rent, and never from charity. But in our modern society, because the political governments have gaps that they're not taking care of, so there are charitable organizations that have moved in to fill those gaps, and those charitable organizations collect charity. And they're collecting that in lieu of taxes or in lieu of rent. And usually those people have a mentality of government.
What about pilots? Pilots?
Pilots. Okay, so you've got, like, if you're a taxi driver, a bus driver, or a pilot, it's all the same thing. It's just like a big bus that flies in the sky. So that's artistry.
What about policymakers?
Policymakers from government, yes. Now you had a question about government?
That was it.
That was it. Woohoo!
Ideas.
If they're a policy advisor, they're in ideas. If they're a policy maker, they're in government. You could be working in ideas as an advisor to government. Yes?
What about like middle management in a company who often have like expertise in artistry, might actually do some engineering work, but also have management responsibilities for looking after teams and coordinating?
Well, most of us do a little bit of work that looks like artistry here and there. First of all, most of our hobbies and recreational things resemble artistry because artistry is the field of pleasure. So, you know, when you want to relax, you go out and play tennis, but you're not a professional tennis player. So all of us have to do some things generally, unless we have a huge amount of people that work for us, that resembles some work as artistry. But if that's not our main work, if that's a small part of our job, and if the main thing is you're taking care of expansion and profit making, then that's resources. Yeah?
What about sectors like energy management and water management and these things? It seems like government is also an industry.
Well, that should be done by government. And if it's done by resources, you have a problem. You're actually going to have a big problem if it's done by resources. Yes?
We talked about police work. What is the difference between a policeman and, for example,
the head of the police is also in government.
Yeah, but the policemen, are they more towards ideas or artists?
No. They're running towards danger people who are dedicated to morals, ethics, and justice in society. At least that's what they're supposed to be, according to their job. Yeah.
You said earlier that the judicial system would be government, but the people in the courts would not be.
The clerks would not be.
The clerks.
Clerk. So you have somebody, you know, the person who's taking notes in the courtroom, they're an artistry.
The court takers.
Yeah. But the bailiff, the judges, the lawyers, those are all in government.
Like Secret Service?
Secret Service is definitely government and definitely not honest. Their whole life is a lie. There are occupations for people who are really good liars. Now, I'm very serious. I'm really, really serious. I mean, if you're expert at lying, you can be an undercover police officer, you can be an intelligence officer. Politicians need to have some diplomacy. They have to. If politicians are completely honest, their field will fall apart. They will start a war. And they'll not encourage the citizenry. It won't work. It's just like if a business person is fully honest about their profit, you won't buy anything there. It won't work. And there's a purport in the 18th chapter where Srila Prabhupada talks about this, how in the field of resources, lying is compulsory, and how in the field of government, diplomacy is compulsory. It's part of the ethics of that field.
I was just relating to a conversation I had with someone around saying they expect governments to tell the truth all the time. And I said, well, I'm a parent. If I told my son the truth
exactly
about everything,
exactly,
how would that help my son?
Exactly.
No,
they actually can't. If they did, it would be a disturbance to society.
And same with raising us as a child.
Because they are the big parents of society.
Yeah,
yes.
But mature understanding.
Yeah, they can. It would be against their dharma to do that. If you want to get unvarnished truth, you go to the field of ideas. Mm-hmm. And the field of ideas are not supposed to be controlled by the other fields. If you want the truth of what's going on in government, you go to a free press. No, I've got to move on because it's 7:30. I mean, unless you're all okay to go like till 9:30, which I don't think you are, and I'm not. So, yeah. That's good.
Honestly.
Yes. Well, I have two classes tomorrow, one that's early in the morning on my other book. Okay, so Krishna says this twice in the Bhagavad Gita. Don't do someone else's work. Don't go into someone else's field. Don't go into someone else's path, even if you think you can do it expertly. Even if you're expert at the craft of another field, don't go into another field. Don't pretend to be something that you're not. Don't be inauthentic. He says, if you do, your work will become a vehicle of fear, bhayavaha. Like you can't drive a bicycle in the water. So on a personal level, when we're doing our own work, we're going to feel enlivened. We're going to feel energized. We may not even care if we eat something. If we're doing someone else's work, we feel depleted. We feel frustrated. We may just procrastinate. We feel irritated. When I'm doing my own work, my mind is my friend. The work I'm doing and my mind is flowing. When doing someone else's work, my mind is going to be my enemy. And I don't have time now, but it's very interesting to me that depending on whose work we're doing that's not ours, will change subtly in which way our mind becomes our enemy. When we're doing our own work, we have natural freedom and detachment. Because our own work is an expression of ourself, and my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, said that when you want something that's natural, that is not a desire. He said, like, if you say, I want to eat, nobody will say, well, what's wrong with you? So when you want to be yourself, that's considered desirelessness. And then you naturally are detached from the results of your work, which gives you a tremendous amount of freedom and peace in whatever you're doing. And when we're doing someone else's work, the only thing we have, the only kind of satisfaction we have are the externals and the results. So we become very attached to them. We're not able to use them very nicely in spiritual service. Okay, going to principle two, advancing through life while nourishing our nature. So here's the difference between being an expert and being a novice. And we're talking about dharmic expertise. You can go to 1,000 places in the world to learn the knowledge and the skills required for your work. But the Vedic wisdom literature is teaching the dharma of your work. Now, the descriptions in those literatures are mostly of the people who have dharmic expertise. So they're describing people in these four fields who are the ideals of dharmic expertise. And we may look at ourselves and say, well, I'm not like that, and I'm not like that, and I'm not like that. What we're looking for in teenagers or in children or in ourselves, if we don't know where we are yet, we're looking for an inclination. What is my inclination? So Krishna says our nature cannot be repressed. So our nature, our inclination is going to manifest whether we've been trained in it or not, whether people appreciate it or not, whether we know how to manifest it or not, whether we're in the right place or not, it's going to come out. Now, ideally, parents, teachers, mentors, guides, help us to introspect and understand what our nature is. And ideally, this is done when we're young. Now, the research shows that people's values are evident by the time they're 13. Now, my own dealing with hundreds of children is that in many cases, that is before that. And sometimes when a kid's 3 or 4, you can tell what their nature is, but at least by 13. Now, because our nature cannot be repressed, it may come out in ways that are disturbing if we haven't been trained in it. Yes? So we have quite a few examples in our book of this. One is of this guy who, when he was going to school, these are all true stories, when he was going to school, hey, cut that out. He's always being sent to the principal's office, right? And when he was 10 years old, his teacher said, stay after class. Oh boy, I'm in trouble again. He said, no, no, you're not in trouble. And the teacher gave him, he became actually a world famous drummer. One young person I know when he was a kid would always get into trouble. Mind your own business. Saying, but that's not fair. That's not fair. He's breaking the rules. Mind your own business. But look, 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 she's doing that. Just mind your own business. And then when he was 18, he got to go on a Krishna tour in Poland, and he was the second in charge of security, and everyone said he was the best leader they ever had because he was minding everybody else's business. So we give many other examples, but sometimes our nature comes out in ways, if it doesn't have the proper expression, it doesn't have the proper training, it may come out in ways that are annoying. Does that make sense to everybody? Yeah? Okay, and we already talked about this slide, so now I have nothing to say about it. Okay, moving on. So, going on to principle 3. See, a lot of people are just interested in what I talked about so far. They think, well, that's the end of it. But just being in the right place isn't enough. We need to find satisfaction and purpose in our work. So now we go to principle 3, which is extending our prosperity to others. So this is the idea of giving charity. Now, the Vedic literature state that how much money we have in this life is directly related to how much charity we gave in other lifetimes. Now, it's interesting, even sometimes people have a big income, but they never have much money. You know anybody like that? It's like they're always in debt, or they have some huge expenses. And so it's not even just how much money you're bringing. How much money do you have is related to how much charity you've given, not what work you do. And the whole principle of charity is to become non-envious. Not greedy, not selfish. At least we should share our prosperity with our family. I mean, the concept of a single unmarried person living alone and using all of their money for gadgets and that is very adharmic. At least give, to a spouse, to kids, to parents, to friends, to the creatures that live around your house in the jungle, give to somebody. Share. Somehow or other, to share. What's really interesting is that modern research shows that not only are we hearing from scripture that charity in previous lives gives us more money in this life, if you're more charitable in this life, now, you'll greatly increase your income. I found this fascinating. Now, charity is not just in money. We have our prosperity types. And whatever kind of richness we're enjoying, we can share. And we have a whole long section in the book about this with many, many examples and many, many suggestions. But the idea is whatever you're enjoying, you should also share with others. What's nice about this is you don't have to have a lot of money to be charitable. If you don't have a lot of spare cash, give some of your time, volunteer. And give some of your time and your energy sharing the types of prosperity you have with others. Is that enough? No, you could be working according to your nature and giving charity, but not doing work that's ethical and meaningful. So the work itself has to be ethical and meaningful. So it should be honest work. You should be honestly representing our goods or services. We should be charging a fair price for our goods or services. If we have employees, we should be paying them fairly and honestly. And then we should produce work of real value. We should produce something that people actually need, that actually add value to society. Nowadays, a lot of work produces things that are completely useless. Nobody needs them. They don't enrich anybody's life. Or things that are harmful, either the tobacco industry, the alcohol industry, the meat-eating industry, pornography, you know, arms dealers. So your work shouldn't be harmful. Now, it's pretty hard to have our work not harm anybody. I mean, maybe the lithium battery in my phone, you know, maybe there's some kid in Africa that's doing slave labor to get the rare metals. It's pretty difficult to say absolutely nobody's going to be harmed. But as far as possible, we should be doing things that are not harmful and add real value to society. Now, we can go a step further and we can add the ultimate expanding value. If all we do is just stick to our dharma and get artha, which is prosperity, and kama, which is then pleasure, if we just stay on that platform externally in the world, eventually we'll feel frustrated and we'll want moksha or liberation. We'll want to leave our career or change careers or something. And eventually that won't be satisfied and we'll go back in the cycle of frustration. So the ultimate value we can add through our work is prema or love. If we have love for our work, love for ourselves, love for the people we serve, and ultimately love for the divine, love for Krishna, then we are able to act as agents of ever-increasing good for people beyond the laws of karma. And this is a very involved and wonderful discussion which we could spend an hour or so on, how we can actually become an agent of expanding good that has no concomitant austerity, no concomitant misery or sacrifice that has to be made, what we call causeless mercy. And anybody can do this through their work. Another way of being ethical, turning again to the second time that Krishna says don't do someone else's work, another way of doing ethical work of value is to make sure we work in our own field. Now, we talked about working in our own field in terms of the harm or the benefit for ourselves, right? If I do my own work, I'm enlivened. If I do others' work, I'm going to be tired, frustrated. I do my own work, my mind is my friend. I do others' work, my mind will be my enemy. I do my own work, I'm naturally detached. If I do others' work, I'm going to be attached. But that's on a personal level. Now we're going to look at a societal level. So this is, again, a whole class that I teach. So I'm going to go through this quickly. I'm just going to give a couple of examples. In our book, we have two chapters on this. One looking at it in a general way of crossing fields, and one looking at all the specifics I'm about to run through with many, many historical and specific examples of these problems in society. Crossing government and resources. What's similar about these fields? Expansive. What else? Diplomacy. Yes, what's different? Concept of justice and honor versus a concept of sustainable wealth. Okay, so when you have people with the mentality of government working in resources, something you said that, yeah? One of you said that. Think about when the government in the former Soviet Union took over the farms. What happened? Starvation. People with the mentality of government taking over a business, they're going to think about social justice. Or we've got to give a lower price to these people because they're poor. Business fails. I've personally seen this happen in some businesses. Yeah. People with the mentality of resources working in government, they're going to try to make what out of government? Profit. They're going to try to profit out of government. In America, we have private prisons. Do they want the prisoners to be reformed, or do they want repeat customers? Crossing government and ideas. What might be some similarities between government and ideas? Well, looking at systems. Looking at the big picture. But government people look at systems to control the systems, and ideas people look at systems to understand and guide from the systems. Some differences. All of those, she says. We want to name one.
Expansive
or satisfied, yes? Honest diplomatic ones. Honest. Okay, what happened with people with the mentality of ideas work in government? They're going to be too merciful. Criminals are not going to get punished. They're going to want to do too much research. Decisions need to be made, and research is going on for 20 or 30 years. I mean, while the people don't get the policies they need. And people with the mentality of government work in ideas. They will politicize knowledge. They'll skew knowledge for political purposes. Which means that people will not trust what comes out of the field of ideas. They may also try to impose their more comfortable hierarchical system on ideas. Ideas has a very egalitarian culture. And by imposing a more hierarchical system, they may stop up the free flow of knowledge. Crossing ideas and resources, some similarity between these. They're both unsentimental. What are some differences?
One's after profit, the other one's after truth.
Yes, profit and truth. Now, when people with the mentality of ideas work in resources, they will feel it's unethical to make a profit. And they'll often just give everything away. Just indiscriminately, they'll just give everything away. Like government people working resources, they'll give more to poor people and whatever, but ideas they just give to everybody. And again, the government fails, and they don't have this expansive, at least the government people have an expansive move like resources, but ideas, they're not expansive, and they're like, well, I don't know. I can grow a garden in my backyard, but I'm not going to grow a whole wheat farm. They just don't have the impetus for it. And what's really interesting is that ideas people will think it's unethical to make a profit. Now, when people in the field of resources work in ideas, they'll think it's unethical to spend time and money on research that doesn't have immediate practical and financial application. Different system of ethics. And so they'll neglect a lot of the work of ideas. This is very common. It's very hard for ideas people who are doing theoretical research to live. You know, resource people who have the money go, well, we're not going to fund this. What use is it? It's unethical. Okay? Also, people with the mentality of resources, if they are working in knowledge, they will use knowledge for, they'll profitize knowledge. Government people with politicized knowledge, resources people will profitize knowledge. If you think about pharmaceutical companies who do research on their pharmaceuticals. And then you have the same problem that people will not trust what comes out of the field of ideas. They'll say it's not objective truth. And that's a terrible harm to society. Because ideas is providing the vision for society, and if people can't trust that, they're blind. crossing government and artistry. What's similar about these fields? Yeah, they're dealing with people. They're directly serving people. What's different?
Government seeks to control, artistry seeks to please.
Yes. Thank you. Excellent. So when people with the mentality of artistry work in government, they don't have this expansive view. It's hard for them to take care of all these people and all this needs. They're like, what do I do? It's all politics. Or because artistry is a much more concrete field, government is much more abstract, artistry people working in government may try to impose concrete structures on government and make it bureaucratic. Also, your government people are running to danger people. Your artistry people are your foundational people. They're not going to run into danger. That's not what they do. We had an instance in America of a school shooting, and some police officers just stayed in the parking lot. This was just in the last year or so. And they asked them why, and they said, well, there was shooting going on. People with the mentality of government working in artistry. These are the controllers of society. They don't want to be in a situation where they have to please people, and they often won't please people. They'll be insubordinate. And artistry is the place where their desire for justice and fairness is the most frustrated, where they have the least way of expressing it. So they may become vigilantes, or they may become some kind of agitators. Now, probably a lot of the people who make agitation on social media perpetually, justice, morals, ethics, justice, these are government people that are in the wrong field, probably stuck in artistry. And they're just like, crossing ideas in artistry. What's similar?
Satisfied
and honest, although it's a different kind of satisfaction and a different kind of honesty. When people with the mentality of ideas work in artistry, now they're going to have the same problem as the government people working in artistry. They don't want to please customers and clients. They're going to be insubordinate. They may be late. There's going to be some kind of rebellion going on. Ideas people need a huge amount of literal and figurative freedom in order to function. And then they're feeling like they're in this really constrained environment. Also, ideas people are usually very detached, and they don't necessarily appreciate that artistry is supposed to provide all the pleasures of society, so they may just dry up the field. Actually, I know someone who's an ideas person working in artistry, and he says, why do the electricians have to make all the wires so beautiful? I said, you're working in the wrong field. People with the mentality of artistry working in ideas, they will sensualize knowledge. And again, you have the same problem. People will stop trusting what comes out of ideas. Or they may just think this is all just abstract stuff. This is like crossword puzzles. What are you going to do this stuff for? They may just neglect the work. They may not be able to cultivate that extreme detachment and objectivity of the field. Crossing resources and artistry, what's similar? They're dealing with the practical stuff of life. I mean, resources is more abstract, but they're dealing with the practical stuff of life. And what's different?
One is more honest.
One is more honest, yes. And one is more expansive. Yes. And one is dealing more with people, and one is more unsentimental. When people with the mentality of resources work in artistry, they want to make it bigger and more profitable. And so they'll turn the, you know, pottery craftsperson, they'll make that a factory. Right? They'll have drug-fueled sports. They'll have entertainment instead of being inspiring. They're going to throw in a bunch of sex and violence to make more money. They're going to have fast foods. They're basically going to destroy the crafts, and they're going to destroy the art and artistry. They're going to destroy the beauty of artistry. And it's innate integrity. What happens when people in the field of artistry work in resources?
It's going to be a problem.
And that can be interesting. It's interesting. I was and I read this just recently after we published the book, people were glorifying like cashiers who stole from their business to give free stuff to poor people who were in the line. You know, oh, you can't pay for their groceries. Okay, I'll just give it to you. You know, or I'll put that in as a discount. And people were saying, oh, how wonderful, how good. I think they're bankrupting the business. They're stealing from their employer. In the name of pleasing the customer and the client. And then their employer's going to go bankrupt. They're not going to have a job. And nobody's going to get anything. Right? And again, they don't have that expansive push. They're not going to want to feed the world. They're not going to want to give wealth to the world. And sometimes when artistry people take over businesses, they may not care about the environment because they're not into the sustainable regenerative world. All right, now we're going to go a little further to progress to dharmic mastery. Now here, this first one, this principle 5 is interesting. This is, you're in the right field, and you're giving in charity, and you're adding value, but you still have to cherish the integrity of your particular prosperity and field of work. So we see a lot of this today, too. People are in the right field according to their inclination, but they don't understand how to cherish the integrity of their field. So looking first at prosperity types. All of our prosperity comes from nature, comes from Mother Earth. In the Vedas, Mother Earth is understood to be the wife of God. If we don't take care of our prosperity, we're like cutting off the head of the goose who laid the golden egg or cutting off the branch of the tree that gives us fruit. So our first source of prosperity is our own mind and body. We should be doing work that's not harming our body and mind. We shouldn't be stressing ourselves physically and mentally in the course of making a livelihood, because then we're cutting off the tree, the branch that gives us fruit. And taking care of others. Don't stress out others in your work, physically or mentally. Right? Take care of the people that you're working with. They're also your source of prosperity. And take care of the planet, which is, again, the source of our prosperity. So these are some ways we can cherish our particular prosperity type. Again, we have this in far more detail in the book. These are just a few examples. Like if I'm enjoying Aishwarya or positional leadership, then I also want to help other people to feel smart and competent. If I'm enjoying Yasha as my prosperity type, I don't want people to respect me even when I've made a mistake. If I'm enjoying Gyan as my prosperity type, I also have to have some emotional intelligence, admit when I'm wrong, and so forth, to keep the integrity of my prosperity type. Then very important is to keep the integrity of our field. Each field has its own dharma. In artistry, people will, if they're following the dharma and cherishing their field, they will sacrifice to protect the integrity and quality of their work, even if other people are pushing them, make more money, do it faster. In resources, they're going to cherish that flow of resources to society. In government, they're going to cherish taking care of people, giving equal justice, not having any special interests, not making a profit out of government. In ideas, they're going to cherish that objectivity of truth. They're not going to become financially beholden to somebody who could convince them to spew the truth. Sixth principle of dharmic mastery is having celebrations of the sacred. So in the natural world, Krishna has this verse in 3:16 of the Bhagavad Gita, evam pravaritam chakram. Chakra means a wheel that's always moving. So in the natural world, the plants and animals, they take from nature, they give back to nature. But we have to do this intentionally. Srila Prabhupada would say, you have to pay your electric bill to the sun. So we should remember that everything's coming from a source. Whether you see the source as the universe, or you see the source as the undifferentiated energy, or you see the source as the soul of the universe, or you see the source as a personal God. In some way, we have to give back to our source. We have to give to the divine. And this means taking time out of our work, out of our normal life on a regular basis, whatever one's faith is, whatever one's spiritual tradition is, and having some time to actually give to the divine. Maybe it's once a week. Ideally, it's every day. And eventually what happens is that giving to the divine starts to permeate our lives so that everything we do is this ceremony of connection. And we have a wonderful guest essay in the book called Every Act of Ceremony. That is, I really, really like that. How everything we do should be this celebration, celebratory ceremony of giving back in this moving chakra. Then our last individual principle is to work above what Dr. Dutt and I call the shades of ego. So this is tamas, sattva, and rajas. So these are different ways in which our work can become polluted with various degrees of ego. So I'd like to introduce you to these guys. Would you like to meet them? Find out who we should avoid, the bad guys, our three bad guys? Yes? All right. So first let's meet Mr. Thomas. All right, so I'm Thomas. You know, I only do things that are easy. I mean, you know, if McDonald's has a vegetarian burger for the same price, I'll buy it. You know? But don't expect me to pay extra money and go to another place. Yeah. I mean, whatever's on the television, if the remote's over there, I'm just going to watch whatever's next. You know, look, I'll do the right thing, you know, if it's not trouble. Right? Like, I don't mind doing the right thing if it's easy, you know. I'm not ambitious. I'm just not ambitious, and I'm not some spiritual person, you know. Just kind of practical, take care of my family, don't insult my family or my friends. We get insulted very easily, and I can insult you back. I'm really good at it. Okay, and then we have Rajas. I'm a very good person. I'm very honest. I work hard. I follow all the rules. I build society. I built the hospitals, the schools, the charities. Do you see all my possessions? Look at that. I worked for all of them. And I will tell you how many hours I worked, how much money I spent to get them, how much trouble I took. I earned every bit of them. I am not lazy, and I'm not some spiritual person, although I do go and pray regularly. And you know, my name will probably be in the history books, and my statue will probably be in the park. And then there's Mr. Sattva. I am Sattva. I am very spiritual. I'm very balanced, I'm very equipoised, I'm very forgiving, I'm very harmonious. I'm not lazy and I'm not ambitious. I like to see the harmony in everything because it makes me feel so good inside. I have a shelf full of crystals and angels. And I see everybody equally, not like those materialistic people. And then there's being above the shades of ego. That's where it's, I'm a soul. I'm a servant of the divine. Life is an adventure. And I'm always finding how I can have play and fun and adventure in everything I do and how I can dedicate everything for the happiness and the service of the divine. The shades of ego, we call them shades of ego because Thomas is like a dark curtain over the window and Rajas is like a sheer curtain. And sattva is like an open window, and out of the shades is like being outside. And these shades are like the dark side of our work. And we will have tendencies, according to the kind of work we do and our personality, to pull from certain of these shades in order to do our work. But they pollute everything. Let's look at charity. So if we give charity in tamas, that means we give the wrong thing to the wrong person, like we give alcohol to an alcoholic. Or we give the right thing to the right person, but without respect. Here, take your charity. Right? Or we give to the right person the right thing, but at the wrong time. We try to give them a charity when they're sleeping or they're on the toilet or something. So then, Rajas, you're giving the right thing to the right person with respect at the right time, but you're calculating. Let's see, if I give this, then I'll get this back. And I'm giving this because my boss or my guru or somebody told me to give it. I don't really want to, but I'm giving it for them because they told me to, and then probably I'll get this benefit. You know, or why did I give that? I could have used it for something else. Sattva, you give to the right person, the right time, with respect, because it makes you feel so good inside. above the shades of ego, you give the right thing to the right person at the right time with respect, because it gives pleasure to Krishna, to the divine. Okay, looking at our work, Thomas disengaged, stubborn, deceitful, insulting, lazy, procrastinating, rajas, greedy, envious, aggressive. Things go well. Yay! Things go poorly. Sattva, steady determination without attachment. Above the shades, this is from Bhagavad Gita 3:30. Three things not to do, three things to do, three things not to do. Don't try to enjoy the prosperity types exploitively. Let go of an exploitive mentality. Basically, make sure you're cherishing them. Don't think you're the owner. I'm not the owner of this body. I'm not the owner of my prosperity. Not the owner of my work. Not the owner of any employees. Not to be lazy or lethargic. Three things to do. Dedicate every moment to our ultimate source, to the divine. Always remember, I'm not this body, I'm not this mind, I'm not this work, I'm not these identifications. I am a transcendent spiritual being and work according to our nature. Yeah?
Could you just clarify the very top one? Let go of desires versus cherishing them?
Yeah, so in other words, if I enjoy yen, but I don't protect the integrity of yen, I don't cherish it, I don't protect it. I exploit it.
Right, so you're sort of preserving the dharma of it?
Yes. Whatever prosperity you enjoy, you preserve its dharma. In Hare Krishna lingo, you enjoy it as prasadam instead of bhoga. Okay. Is that clear? And Prabhupada often talks about that. Whatever we get, we should take it as the Lord's mercy, the Lord's grace, the Lord's kindness, the Lord's prasadam. All right, those are the seven individual prosperity types. We're going to look briefly at the whole system. So principle 8 is maintaining societal balance, cooperation between the fields, and competition between the fields. So you were asking me about different fields working in one organization. So this is how the different fields interact within a small organization or within society at large. So there's cooperation between the fields, like ideas, trains, and guides everyone else. Government approves licensing, accreditation. It provides venues and facilities to launch projects or repair or maintain cooperative efforts. Resources organizes, directs, and distributes the flow of money and materials and energy and other resources. And artistry is assisting all of the other joint endeavors. Now, it would be wonderful if everybody worked in their own field and cherished their own field. But some people are still not going to do that. So we need some system of checks and balances. So ideas holds government to the rule of law. This is the function of a free press. Government regulates through law. Resources regulate through where and how they spend their money. Artistry has a check and balance through their numbers, because the greatest number of people work in their field, but also through what they choose to translate. For example, recently in the United States, there were some people who were website designers or bakers who said, we have freedom of speech and we are going to have on our websites and in our bakery things that we believe in, regardless of what the law is, and they won their cases. It's the artistry people who decide what to put in theater, what to put in film, what to put in books, you understand? What to put in music. And they, in a very large way, can therefore control the values of society in general. Then within each field, there should be competition. Now, in theory, we should want to do our best for its own sake. But in practice, when we have an opponent, it kind of encourages us to do our best. It focuses our mind. It makes us think about kind of hitting the edge of our abilities, finding our own potential. Now, this should be healthy competition and respectful competition. We're not trying to erase our competition. We're not trying to be predators. But you think about a jewelry district or a fashion district where you have a lot of similar businesses in the same area that benefits both the businesses and the customers. So competition in artistry brings us masterpieces and invention. and resources, better quality of resources and better quality of distribution of resources. Competition in government, think of the benefits of having more than one political party, or the benefits of having different types of governments that human beings can try out. Competition in the field of ideas, keep science, religion, philosophy responsive to time, place, and circumstance and maintains the purity. The last principle on the whole system is all-inclusive, sustainable prosperity. So modern economists made a deliberate, conscious, explicit decision to separate economic theories from natural resources. They said, we no longer want economics to have anything to do with land. And modern economists define economic prosperity as growth. What's wrong with that?
Can't grow and find your tent wherever.
Thank you. Sometimes it takes 10 people before we get to that. If I had an extra piece of cake, I would give it. You cannot have infinite growth on a finite planet. So what's going to happen if you're equating prosperity with growth? You're going to be forcing. You're going to be forcing the land through artificial fertilizers and pesticides. You're going to be forcing the animals with hormones and antibiotics. You're going to be forcing trades. Everybody can eat strawberries all year. You're going to be forcing people. You're going to be forcing people to work beyond their capacity or in unnatural ways. You're going to create a huge wealth disparity in the world. People are going to be pushing for growth, 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 but not everybody can have that growth, growth, growth. So instead, our final principle is there should be all-inclusive, sustainable prosperity. And the third part of our book, we detail this relationship between the fields. We have a chapter on sustainable prosperity. We have a chapter on what we call mathematical eco-sociology. And we look at a very specific example. And we have a chapter called Vision for a Whole Society. So we're giving a template for how this can be instituted on a broad scale. So we looked at identifying our ideal career field and prosperity type, learning the secrets of making our work deep and meaningful, progressing to Dharmic mastery, and the whole system for peace and prosperity, and our 9 principles. So, obviously I couldn't cover everything in here in this time, but I picked out at least the essence of it. Is there anybody, and we do have a few copies left. Does anyone have any more other questions or comments? Yes?
How important is considering your spouse's field, in relationship, and that you can connect with? Yeah. What's the relevance of that? What's the importance of taking that into consideration?
Traditionally, the idea was that people should marry who had the same career. And the idea of that was that the spouses could work together in a partnership. That was the idea. Now, today that often doesn't happen. And then what's, I would say, essential is to recognize that your partner is going to have a different view of what is dharmic and what is ethic than you do. Bless you. Do you follow? And to recognize that all of these are beautiful in their own place. Yes?
How does this relate with Prabhupada's project of the rural community education?
That's mostly 9. Starting to have economic systems that are in tune with natural resources. Also, your question relates to his point, which I don't know if I have time, because it's already 8:15, to get into in depth here, but how industrialization, by removing careers from the home, particularly affected women. The women used to be able to have their careers at home with the support of extended family. And industrialization, by moving everybody to one place, destroyed extended family and pulled careers out of the home. And women then had to choose between staying home and taking care of their babies and working according to their nature. And because at that time, women were having an average of 6 children, they didn't really have a choice. They had to choose to stay home. And then when the home became, also, at least they were busy at home. I mean, you had to wash your clothes by hand, and you had to grind your own grain. And especially, you know, industrialization, most of the servant class disappeared, and extended family disappeared. So you had a lot to do. So the women were very frustrated, but at least they weren't bored. And then come to the industrialization of the home and widespread birth control and abortion, people are having 2.8 children. And you've got a washing machine, you have a refrigerator, and you can buy sliced bread. And so by 1950, women were both frustrated and bored. And in the 60s and 70s, they said, wait a minute, we're going to choose career over home. They reversed it, which has not been a very good thing for a family. It's been very good for women feeling fulfilled, but it hasn't been a very good thing for the structure of society. So if we're going to go back, especially for women, to be able to have all of their nature taken care of, then we need a more simple society. And also, if we want to stop the huge wealth disparity, it's just not fair that there are people who have like $350 billion. It's almost obscene. And other people don't have clean water. And that's all because of this artificial growth theory that's being taught in the universities as economic theory. So to go back to seeing that prosperity has to do with the land, and this also has to do with cherishing our sources of wealth, that our ultimate source of wealth is the planet. We don't take care of it, we're all going to be impoverished. What they call dystopia. You know, we're all going to be in a dystopia if we don't start taking care of our planet. Like, duh, people. You know. Does this mean that there won't be any cities and that everybody will have a cow? No. I don't plan on having a cow. So, you know, it's be a little awkward on the plane. It's my emotional support, cow. So, but we to have all of this without, can you do 1 through 7 without 8 and 9? Yes, you can do a lot of 1 through 7 without 8 and 9. You don't have to have the proper society to get most of the benefit on an individual level of career going, thankfully. But if we really want to benefit society overall, we need especially people in the field of government who are going to be working on 8 and 9. Yes?
So, oh, wait, do you...
Yes, you!
Wait, I was just wondering, because I have a different question, but you started talking about, like, women, and I guess how, like...
Well, he started talking about women. Well, it wasn't my fault. Yeah. That was his fault.
No, but it's interesting, like, yeah, how you talked about how, like, women's lifestyles only have changed recently, like, in terms of education and things, which kind of relates to this a lot, because we have, like, more opportunities to actually, like, pursue something?
Well, pre-industrial society, women had careers.
But you were saying, like, mostly they were housewives.
That was what. Well, that was the result of industrialization.
Yeah.
So that was not the situation pre-industrialization. Did you follow?
What was it pre?
You had extended families, you had servants, people worked from home, and both men and women had careers out of the home.
But then you said you think it's kind of like changed society a bit to have women, like,
kind of, you know, a bit,
like,
yes.
What do you think is the negative part, or like the positive parts about that?
Positive part is that women are finally able to engage their propensities and work according to their nature. What do you think?
I don't know.
What do you think? How many children, what's the percentage of children are growing up with their natural biological parents? How much stability is there in marriage?
I don't know, I'm sorry.
How many people are having, you know, a long string of various relationships that start and stop and start and stop and damage them emotionally before they end up in a stable relationship?
I'm just grateful for my parents, I guess.
Anyway, that's definitely related to the fact that women are now able, but they made this choice. Women shouldn't have to make that kind of a choice.
Thank you.
We should be able to have a loving partner and produce children and be able to work according to our nature.
Do you think
just like men should be able to have a loving partner, produce children, and work according to their nature, so should women. But we have a little different biology. The last time I checked. So it's a little bit more entangling when you're the one who gets pregnant and you're the one who's breastfeeding. It just is. We might like to say it isn't, but it is. I mean, I've done it myself, so I can tell you, it is. So there should be a situation where you can do everything, where you can have a holistic life. And before industrialization, people did. Now, I'm not suggesting we go back to 1700, okay? I don't want to go back to 1700. But I would like to bring in that balanced society in our present situation. It's going to look a little different than the 1700s. But I'd like to see us bringing back community. I'd like to see us bringing back the dignity of servant work. I'd like to see us bring back the dignity of community. I'd like us to bring back working from home. Then you do that, and both men and women are going to have a holistic life. I mean, men also by industrial society, you know, they have to, right, someone was just telling you the day, you know, I have to drive an hour to get to work, I have to drive an hour to get back from work, I'm working at work 8 hours, I never get to see my kids. That was a man saying that to me. I want to spend time with my family. Why did I have kids if I never get to see them? So this is, it's a general problem for everyone. It affects women more because females get pregnant and nurse. I mean, that's kind of the definition of female biology is pregnancy and lactation. So because of that, it tends to be more entangling. Do you follow? Does that make sense? So a society that's more tied to the natural resources of the planet, it's going to give people a more holistic life, and it will particularly benefit females. It will also particularly benefit children, who can start to learn their career at a young age in the area of their family and their community, instead of waiting until they're 22. What do I want to do? It would eliminate a lot of the extreme poverty of the world. It would make it very difficult for people to have $350 billion. And it would have an economic concept of balance and sustainable prosperity, all-inclusive sustainable prosperity, rather than an economic concept of unlimited growth.
In Hare Krishna's, I'm sorry if this is offensive, but
I don't mind.
Okay.
I'll tell you if I don't like it.
Is it like traditionally like you're meant to be a housewife if you're a woman, like in the Hare Krishna's?
So I'm not sure who these Hare Krishnas are. Like, we have hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of members. So I'm sure and certain that some of our members think that what would be ideal is if we went back to 1950, when women were both bored and frustrated. But it looked really peaceful. I was in Germany recently, and right before, there was a stream, and right before the waterfall, the waters were really so people might look at 1950s and say, oh, that's what we want. So we have a wide variety of people in the Hare Krishna movement. If some personality type or political viewpoint exists in the world, they're in our movement too. So I'm sure and certain, absolutely, I guarantee you there's people in our Hare Krishna movement who will think that if we all went back to 1950, it would be a really good idea. But I'm in the Hare Krishna movement, and I don't think that. So, you know.
Just different types of people in the movement.
So I'm not sure what you mean by in Hare Krishna. Like who Hare Krishna? Which Hare Krishna? Where Hare Krishna?
No, I understand.
Then I'm just saying, we're not a monolithic... We're not like some monolithic group that we're all just, we all believe. I mean, there's certain things, okay? Everyone in the Hare Krishna movement believes that we are not this body and mind and we are a soul. And that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. And that we reincarnate. I mean, we have certain things that we all ascribe to. But other, you know, in the details, we have different viewpoints. We have political conservatives and we have political liberals. And we have all different viewpoints. If you're going to talk about what is the view in our scripture, it's not what you describe. It's not that. In our scripture, we have Draupadi, who's born from the fire. She was the empress. She said she was the only one who knew the income and expenditure of the kingdom, and that was the whole planet. She was the wife of the emperor of the king of the whole planet. She said she managed a royal household of 100,000 people. That's like a city. We have the gopis. What does gopi mean? Literally. Cow herding girls. They would go across the river with their milk products to sell them. They were businesswomen. So if you look at our scripture, you don't find this concept. If you look at our scripture, if you look at the old tradition, you do not find this concept. You find the concept that both men and women have propensities in various careers, in all these four fields. And like this one gentleman was saying, that there was a big consideration of trying to have people marry who were in the same field. If there was no concept of women having a field, there'd be no discussion of having equality of fields of marriage, right? There'd be no meaning to it. So that is actually the philosophy of our scriptures. Does everybody understand that? No. So I'm sure you could meet a Hare Krishna who would say, you know, it would be really nice if we were in 1950. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I just feel like sometimes it feels like they always are empowered more. But,
yeah. Yeah, they generally are in the world. Yeah,
I think that's just like,
that's generally how it goes.
But
I don't know. I mean, that's a kind of a big topic.
Yeah.
There is a tendency in the world for those who have more power in various ways to lord it over those who have less power in various ways. Mm-hmm. For the rich to exploit the poor. For people who have more muscle strength to exploit those who have less. For those who have more IQ to exploit those who have less. There's a tendency like that in the world in general. But in an actual dharmic society, that doesn't go on. Can you eliminate that 100%? No. There's always going to be some exploitation in the world. There's always going to be some people who use their strength and power for exploitation. But Krishna says that he personally, we have this in our Krishna Meditations book, that he is personally the strength of the strong, devoid of passion and desire. And we'll be talking about this tomorrow morning. Krishna says that he is memory of women, he is intelligence of women, he is steadfastness of women, he is the patience of women. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Vinavanaya sampane brahmani gavi hasane suni chai vasupakekta pandita sami darshana. An actual wise person sees equality, sees spiritual equality, and doesn't exploit anybody. But there's a tendency in this world for exploitation, and if somebody has power over somebody else in whatever way, there's a tendency to be exploited. We're not going to fully and totally eliminate that tendency, and therefore you're always going to find some exploitation in the world. So our founder, Srila Prabhupada, was once asked, do women have to follow the men? And Prabhupada said, we have to follow Krishna, men and women both.
Thank you so much.
Is that all right? I mean, we can also talk about different male-female psychology, but that's always a generalization. There's generalizations which may hold true for a certain percentage of people, but they're not absolutely true. Yes.
Could you say the same thing about these fields, the generalizations, and if there's sort of...
Well, each field is very broad. So your basic principles of Dharma hold true for that whole field. But then you've also got the prosperity types. And you've got broad, very broad careers that are all within that field. I mean, a scientific researcher and a full-time pujari, that's quite different, but they're both in the field of ideas and they both have the same values. You know, it may seem like a wheat farmer, an investment banker are very different kinds of jobs, but it's the same dharma applies to both. So yes, these are very, very broad fields, and there's a vast variety of careers within that field with a variety of mixture of prosperity types for each of them. But the same dharma does hold true within that field. As we see, these are mutually exclusive, so you can't have a mix. You can't be both satisfied and expansive.
First of all, thank you. This has been amazing.
I
love how you took the knowledge of Krishna consciousness and made it so immensely practical.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
That's very... I'm thrown away.
Thank you.
My question is, for like one through seven of this,
yes.
Do people get the benefits of this individually, or does there need to be some kind of organizational and structural change?
Well, organizational structural change is in 8 and 9. The others people can do individually. Of course, if you're in a rotten, lousy structure, it may to some extent impede your ability to achieve those. And we talk about this in the book. I mean, if you're working in an environment where no one else is cherishing the field and no one else is cherishing your prosperity type and half the people are in the wrong field, it's going to be far more of a challenge for you to follow Dharma. I mean, but this is true in general. You know, like if you don't drink alcohol and you're in some environment where everybody's drinking all the time, you know, where everyone else is watching all the soccer games and you're not. You know, I mean, that's always somewhat of a challenge. And we discuss how to deal with those kind of things. So can you deal with all seven perfectly in every situation? Well, you can always do seven, you know. What can you do even in a terrible environment? Can always do seven, you can always do six. Five may be a little bit of a challenge if you're in a very bad environment. Keeping the integrity of your field. Keeping the integrity of your prosperity type. You know, as far as possible, we should try to put ourselves in environments where other people are going to be in that mood. Okay. Number four, I mean, you can be that yourself, but sometimes it's very hard to be that yourself if you're in a very unethical work environment. Where your boss is telling you, overbill for your time. And that happened to my son. You know, he was able to do his work in 1/4 the time as the other consultants, and his boss said, inflate your hours. And he's like, I don't want to do that. Well, then you can't work here anymore. So, you know, that can sometimes be a challenge. During work of value, generally we have some control over that. You know, you don't have to work in a tobacco company. Right? You don't have to manufacture completely useless things that people are going to throw away next month. One and two are definitely things that we can do. We can definitely find work according to our nature if you have faith that our source is benevolent. Whether you see our source as a universe, what we call in Sanskrit the Virat Rupa, if you see our source as just undifferentiated energy, you see our source as the soul of the universe and the father of the universe, or you see our source as a personal, playful, loving God. If you believe that our source is benevolent, that there's not just random chaos everywhere, then there'd be some push on a grand scale for us to be in the right place. Like, I want my heart muscles to be in my heart. I don't want them in my liver. You know? So there's help. When we want to be in our right place and we want to be nourished in our right place, we will get help. We will get divine help. But yeah, some of these are definitely challenging if you're in what they call now a toxic environment. But even some, I mean, some of us can do quite a bit towards 8 and 9, even on an individual level. It's not an all or nothing proposition. But Dr. Dutta and I, Rukmini and I, we're hoping that we will get some leaders in the field of government reading this book. There already are some who are going to say, hey, let's try our place as a test place to put this into effect as a community. It's about two or three places that we're talking with right now. Did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, just on there, it seems that a lot of the problems that we're facing in the world today are to do with people being disconnected from the essential power of their work.
Yes.
With that in mind, and with the fact that society is continuing to become more and more interconnected and collectivized, globalized, you could even say, at what scale do you think it's likely that we'll actually be able to practically implement these stages at 8 and 9 when the people that are essentially taking control, you know, you have business people in government essentially, and
I don't know.
Reverse, you know,
I know that this is the desire of God. And I know this is the desire of my spiritual teacher. And I'm just trying to do my little part. I don't work in the control room. Yeah. I'm just a little pawn. But I have faith that because it's their desire, that if we each do our little part, that it can happen. My baseline objective is that people just say, oh, wow, this makes so much sense. To just see that the Vedic literatures are giving us not only a really cool and amazing and far out and wonderful philosophy of transcendence, but also an amazing, cool and far out wonderful philosophy of how we can live socially and economically and psychologically and socially. So that's my bottom line. If you just that's all you walk away with, even if you don't do anything, if you're just like, wow, that's really cool, I'm happy. My next tier of objective is if you actually do something. And you go, oh, there's this change I could make. Maybe it's a little change, maybe it's a big change. My next tier of happiness is if you decide you want to work for this. And if you say, I want to start teaching people this, I want to start helping people with this, I want to start establishing this. So I've got a few people like that so far. But I don't know. That's not... Krishna says you do your duty and you're detached from the result. That's up to him. You know, and sometimes it's a question of reaching a critical mass. There's a certain number of people get this and they go, that's what we want. And sometimes it's a matter of hitting the right person. Hitting a person with the power and the drive and the position to say, we're going to do this. We're going to do this in our little community of 100 people. Right now, as I said, I have about 3 people that are talking about this that are interested in it. So we'll see. Guardedly skeptical and guardedly enthusiastic. It'd be lovely to see it in the world, wouldn't it? I mean, you know, we have right at the end of the book, we have this vision for a whole society and what a sustainable prosperity looks like. And you know, sometimes as I'm talking about this, it happened to me the other day in the car actually, that I actually can see it a little bit. I can feel it a little bit as if it's already there. Will it be perfect? Nah, you know, in the material world. But you know, to see that we could actually have something like that. Is that all right for the answer? I think it's possible. And I don't think I'm just being idealistic and naive to think it's possible. I think it's possible. How we're going to get from A to B, I don't exactly know. I doubt that. I don't know about that. Maybe. everyone has their own intelligence and their own way. I'm sure you're smarter than me in many ways. But, you know, I my guess is first it would happen in a micro scale. That's my guess. But all it takes is the right one or two people who have that. It's always been that way. It's been that way since the beginning of time. Yes?
Is this very closely related to Lord Chaitanya's golden age within Kali-yuga?
I certainly hope so. Because you really couldn't have a golden age just of people chanting Hare Krishna. Do you follow? It's integrated. We don't have a world-denying philosophy. Or someone said to me, it's not like you take your love of God and run. Srila Prabhupada was primarily trying to teach us that we're not these bodies, that we're souls, that this world's temporary, and we should fall in love with Krishna and enter into our eternal relationship with Him. But He spent a huge amount of time and energy and effort to describe an ideal society and to ask us to build an ideal society. He wasn't just concerned on the transcendent realm. Can you become fully self-realized without any of this? Well, not without 7 and 6, but without the rest of it. Could you become fully transcendent? Yeah, you could. But it's a lot easier when all this is in place. Even on an individual level, when we're in the wrong place, our spiritual life becomes so much more difficult. And many times when people talk to me about struggles in their spiritual life, they're not doing anything wrong with their spiritual practices, but the rest of their life is all messed up. And it's acting as an impediment. It's like, could we have this class out in the middle of the road? Well, yeah. But it would be an impediment. Do you follow?
Yeah.
The room isn't the knowledge. The room, the PowerPoint, the whiteboard, that isn't the knowledge. But without it, it's very difficult. Or if you've ever been in a classroom that's like too hot or too stuffy or too cold or everybody's hungry or, you know. I mean, I was just even struggling with being in a class because I'm in mourning. I can't remember what day it was. It took like 5 minutes to remember what year it was. So, you know, when you have some disturbance in your... I had to compartmentalize that to go on. You know, when you have some disturbance on that level, then it's very difficult to do. Do you follow? Does that make sense? Yes? Yes?
How can those in the area... How can those with a career in the field of ideas sustain themselves without being compromised?
It's hard, isn't it? It's really hard. Because people outside the field of ideas see a lot of the work of the field of ideas as useless. Auckland was the only place in the whole Hare Krishna world that gave me space to work on Learn to Read. Every other place said, we need to use all of our facility for people who do local work for our local temple. We can't facilitate somebody writing international curriculum. It was the only place, by the grace of Kalasambara and Prana. And you. And your wife. So it's a problem. You know, part of this whole culture is people understanding you've got to give charity to people in the field of ideas. And you've got to facilitate people in the field of ideas, and they actually are doing something useful. Even though it doesn't always seem like that. You know, we talked about how often children who have their nature and they haven't been trained in it may become just be disturbing, right? So I was teaching this in our school in North Carolina, and one of the kids there said, yeah, I'm always getting in trouble for thinking. And then I asked his mother, I said, is that true? She said, yeah. She said, I'll be saying, Adwaita Chandra, what are you doing? I'm thinking. Why don't you do something useful? So it's a problem. On the positive side, people in the field of ideas tend not to care so much about creature comforts if they have a vibrant mental and intellectual life. And so generally their needs are lower. But, you know, we're in a society where there's government codes for good reason, that you have to have certain walls and certain windows and certain plumbing, and so your degree of simplicity that you can have is also limited. I mean, the government codes are there for good reason. It's not like they're just, it's not like they're only trying to harass us, although sometimes it feels like that. But, you know, that it's difficult in modern society. Also, our whole climate has changed. You know, in Siberia, it used to be subtropical. You know, your outback also used to be a forest. So it's just like, you know, if you live in Hawaii, it's really easy to live with, to just live outside. I mean, I have a friend, before she joined the Hare Krishna movement, she just lived outside for a year. And she gained weight on just coconuts and avocados. So, you know, it's also a problem that we're facing. So it's difficult. I mean, one thing you can do is you can try to get financial support from a wide variety of sources, not just one. That helps. That's something that I really, really try to do. Try not to be dependent on any one or main source. I mean, I had kind of a big lesson about that at one point in my life. I don't do that. Problem is, it's 8:45, and so it's late, and people are already leaving because it's late, and just what that is. And I need to get to bed also. It's this funny thing, I have a physical body, and it has to do this strange phenomenon called sleep. So, thank you very, very much. And we do have some copies of our book, which you can get from Baba Sunday, and if you like, I can sign them for you. Ta-da! And we also have some copies of our other book, Krishna Meditations, which is, again, how to find the divine in the birds and the trees and the water and the your breathing and all your abilities. And we will be teaching that tomorrow, both in the morning and the afternoon. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Jai.